a cappella performance of Roy Orbison's song Crying, sung in Spanish by Rebecca Del Rio, Llorando, from the soundtrack David Lynch's Mulholland Drive. Before all that, 7-inch from RST. The song was called Burnout. It was a split 7-inch with Insect Factory, and it was preceded by Jonas Brash from a great CD called Quartet for the End of Space. Other people involved here include Paulina Oliveros, Francisco Lopez, and Doug Van Noort. We heard a track from Jonas Brash called Snowdrifts, and it was accompanied by Bionulor, a CD called Sacred Mushroom Chant, and the track, ahem, I'm practicing my Polish all afternoon, I'm sure I'll still fail. Nichni jest pracwi. No, pracwi. Nichni jest pracwi. United Waters before that, a side project of a member of Malthus. LP called Your First Ever River. From it we heard Spires 2. Space Needle from 1995's Voyager CD. The song was Starry Eyes. And we opened that set with music from a new Weird Australia comp entitled We Are After All Here. The band was Rights Wild. The song was Rights Wild Theme. Running out of time here. I'm only here till 6 p.m. My name is Scott. Thank you for listening. Benjamin Walker's here in just about 6 minutes. 6 minutes is enough time to do quite a lot. So maybe I'll play music by Dolly Dawn and George Hall and his orchestra. And maybe something else. And we'll say goodnight. Okay, bye-bye.
Thank you. So I said, you know, wash your hands and make me a cheese sandwich, huh?
Yeah.
And a palsy from the big chief says, you are some scout for big Roman nose on the Champagne River, horses with women made from matchsticks to start fires with. An awful pleasant in the sweet summertime. Jafila last squeezed a diamond from her clasped bosom, so the heart merry leapt with joy.
Yeah. Oh, don't get me started, people. Come on.
Okay. I got one for you. How do you know when blue cheese goes bad? Huh?
Think about it. Come on, think about it.
Okay, I'll tell you. It's when his grades start slipping at the blue cheese school. And all those blue cheese friends he hangs around with, they're bad. They have very large plans for him to be a skin diver in Naples and call him Fasu and float with him in the big night. So the cop says, you're going to kill that baby. And I said, okay. And he said, no, that's against the law. And I said, I did not know that. And he said, well, ignorance ain't no excuse. I said, I didn't know that either. So, you know, the baby died. What's the best time to go to the dentist? I say 2:30.
2:30.
Okay, well, folks, you've been swell. You've been wonderful. If you've enjoyed this half as much as I have, then I've enjoyed it twice as much as you have, and you really ought to try harder next time. If I'm ever in a kilt, please look me up. I am Chip Muncie. You are you. And I don't want to go, but I guess I gotta go, cause if I don't go, I'm gonna never get home. Oh, yeah. Good night, people.
This is WFMU in East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope Worldwide, WFMU.org. Stay tuned for too much information.
I'm honored to shake the hand of a brave Iraqi citizen who had his hand cut off by Saddam Hussein. And with six other Iraqi citizens as well who suffered the same fate. They are examples of the brutality of the tyrant. Our enemies are innovative and resourceful, and so are we. They never stop thinking about new ways to harm our country and our people, and neither do we. We are working with our friends to keep the pressure on the mullahs to listen to the demands of the free world.
Hated man and terrorist in the world, Osama bin Laden, to Geronimo is really just incredibly ignorant, and it just demonstrates how the outsiders do not even remotely consider that the Native community is relevant, and that speaks volumes to the contemporary experience of Native people today.
When it came out that the military had given Osama bin Laden the codename of Geronimo, Native people responded with outrage and disgust. Dustin Craig is a White Mountain Apache writer and filmmaker. In 2007, he directed a documentary about Geronimo for PBS's American Experience. I asked him what the fuss is all about.
The symbol of Geronimo is one of resistance, one of striving to maintain freedom, you know, in the face of incredible odds and oppression. During a time of war, this one small group of Apache people stands up to the United States and essentially outdoes them. You know, they are uncatchable. And so this symbol is a symbol of what Native people are capable of when they are armed with the intellect contained within their culture and their language. There is generally a, you know, universal respect for the symbolism that he embodies throughout the world. He is a very poignant reminder of resistance to all of the efforts that this country has made to change Native Americans.
We're talking about the 1800s here. Change is not exactly the fitting word.
No, definitely. Like in that time period, let's say, for example, the Arizona Star here in Arizona was actually publishing articles on how to best poison pinon meats and, you know, vegetables and stuff, flour with strychnine. And the best ways and places to leave them out for Native people, specifically Apaches, so that they might find them and ingest them. You know, and that was this was, you know, a war of attrition, a war of extermination. if you're an Apache person in the Southwest during that time period.
So, Dustin, as an expert on the life and story of Geronimo, do you see any parallels between his life and Osama bin Laden?
Because of the way in which the media really zeroed in on Geronimo and his evasion of the United States Army and their efforts to subdue him, then yes, there are very clear parallels between the two. For example, in our research for the American Experience film, we were digging up newspaper headlines of the time period, and I was amazed when we pulled one up, either from an Arizona or New Mexico publication, and the headline was literally, "Terrorism Prevails in Arizona." And this is like 1885. So the language has always been there when it comes to trying to sort of demonize or vilify people who resist the idea of America. When we look at the war against Native peoples, the war to destroy Native peoples so that America might thrive, the campaign against the Apache people is the last military campaign. And in that time period, the Apache people were demonized very much in the same way that terrorists and through association of their religion and culture, Muslims are being demonized. So there's sort of where the similarity lies. Geronimo was very much demonized and vilified to the American public by the media in the same way that Osama bin Laden has. The difference is Geronimo wasn't the mastermind of a catastrophic event that killed thousands of people in the blink of an eye. So if there is a connection, I think it is the fact that Geronimo was symbolic of the end of the Indian Wars. And to America, the Indian Wars represented this direct opposition, the greatest impediment to America fulfilling its manifest destiny. And so there was a lot of celebration when it came to trying to eradicate Geronimo because he symbolized the last recalcitrant resisting Native American leader of the time period.
The Osama bin Laden operation not only opens up the world's top boogeyman spot to a new contender, fresh blood, but it also gives rise to a number of questions. Some of these questions might seem trivial to many of you, but I, for one, want to know the answer to every single one. Osama bin Laden was living with his three wives. Did they have to share a room, or did they each have their own? Did one get stuck in a room with a bad view? And where exactly was this marijuana growing? Was it inside the compound or merely on the property, perhaps growing next to the wall? Some of the questions might make you uncomfortable, like, did we shoot him unarmed in cold blood? And where exactly did the intel come from? There are just too many questions, but I can't do one of those fancy data visualization tricks so popular with the kids today. This is radio after all, folks. So allow me to try and sort this out for you the old-fashioned way. On the one hand, we have what has been officially said, released, and shown. And on the other hand, we have what has not been said, not been released, and not shown. I want you to keep your eye on these two cards, because I'm now going to show you a disinformation trick. But if you don't pay attention, dear listener, I promise you, you will leave the table empty-handed. On the surface, the official story is simple. Somehow, the United States got its hands on intelligence that led them to Osama bin Laden, who was living in Abbottabad, Pakistan, pretty much kitty-corner to a military academy. Special forces then went in and killed him. his body was buried at sea. The Obama administration has done its best to provide the press and the American people with a detailed narrative of how it all went down. But the story keeps changing. For example, it was first reported that the special forces met intense resistance and that Osama bin Laden used one of his wives as a human shield. But then, after millions of people all over the world shared, tweeted, Facebooked, and reblogged these facts, they were retracted. Now, this is not bumbling incompetence. This is propaganda at work. These are professionals working from a script, and it's a blockbuster. My personal favorite detail is that the operation went down on May 1st. Neo-Nazis will now be forced to share the anniversary of the death of their beloved Führer with a man with a big beard and a turban. And just as that fact about Osama bin Laden using his wife as a human shield chips away at his martyr cred, that burial at sea deprives him of a shrine. Like I said, this script is a masterpiece. Where I want you to focus your attention, though, is on what has not been officially said, released, or shown. Obviously, 1 week later, the primary issue here is that photo of Osama bin Laden with a bullet in his head. The Obama administration's decided not to officially release this photo, but I assume, just as he did with his birth certificate, he will eventually, or it'll be leaked. Numerous Americans have voiced their frustration with his decision. Perhaps Sarah Palin puts it best in a tweet she sent out on May 4th. Show photo as a warning to others seeking America's destruction. No pussyfooting around. No politicking. No drama. It's part of the mission. But this debate on whether or not Obama should parade down Fifth Avenue with bin Laden's head on a pike is also part of the script. It keeps us from discussing something that's much more important. The photo is totally irrelevant. In fact, I would argue only one fact really matters. Where did we get the intel? This is the question that's fueling the most interesting discussions in the media and the best conspiracy theories online. The writer Tariq Ali offers perhaps the most plausible explanation. Someone in the ISI sold OBL out to the USA. Of course, when they make the movie The Hunt for Osama bin Laden, the intel will come from a prisoner being waterboarded in Guantanamo. Perhaps they'll throw in a few more steps, but mark my words, this movie will connect what went down in Guantanamo to what went down in Abbottabad. It's one of the key plot points. Because if a line can be drawn between Guantanamo and the death of Osama bin Laden, then America can purge itself of some serious guilt. I know I must sound dreadfully old-fashioned, but this is very important, trust me. Without proof or evidence, I don't think we should buy this story, no matter who is selling it. Perhaps one of Osama bin Laden's wives got fed up with OBL hogging the TV. Perhaps she got sick and tired of looking at her tiny bedroom window that got no light. Maybe she slipped word out to someone. Perhaps one of Osama bin Laden's neighbors noticed the marijuana plant growing next to the compound. And convinced that the neighborhood was going to pot, he called in a complaint. I know that's a lot of conjecture, so I'll leave you with one thing I'm 100% certain of. That intel did not come from Umarov Mohiboullo.
His name is Umarov Mohiboullo.
Umarov?
Umarov. You.
Umarov.
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 Mohiboullo.
Mohiboullo.
H. Mohiboullo.
And how old is he?
Chancellor.
24.
I met Mohiboullo Umarov in the Obihengu Valley, which is in Tajikistan's Pamir Mountains. And he lived there with his family, including a younger brother who's missing a leg. The brother lost it when they were boys and during the civil war in Tajikistan, when a bomb dropped on their grandparents' potato field. And Mohiboullo himself suffers ailments from his time in prison.
And how did you end up in the valley?
Well, that's a longer story.
Mackenzie Funk has traveled the globe writing magazine articles about faraway places like Siberia and Greenland. In 2006, he wrote a story about his encounter with Umarov Mohibolo for Mother Jones magazine. But the story begins with a mountaineering trip he took in 2003.
I had a long interest in Central Asia, and that's the former Soviet Union, all the different stans, as they're called. So Tajikistan, Kyrgyzstan, Kazakhstan, Turkmenistan, Uzbekistan, if I didn't say that one already. And even in college, I'd always wanted to visit them because they seem so off the map. And eventually I did. The first time I went into this region, Vakhio, was on a mountaineering trip. And part of the appeal of this, of the Pamir in Tajikistan in particular, is there's these beautiful mountains that no one ever has really explored in the last decade. It's just sort of, it was always off the map, but it dropped more off the map as soon as the Russians left. And how it happened that I went into that valley was on a mountaineering trip with my friend Lars. And people had told us, don't go into that valley. That is where the Islamic movement of Uzbekistan walks back and forth when they're doing their attacks. And so it's dangerous for you to go there. But as we were doing this high mountain traverse, we ended up walking down this valley, which is the Surhab River in the Vakhio region. And we go down there, and all these villagers were hailing us, saying, hello, hello. And all the signs of these militants that we'd been worried about, people said, avoid that valley, and they weren't there. And eventually we asked, and in broken Russian, my Russian isn't great, but it's good enough to talk to people a little bit, said, well, what about the militants? And they're like, oh, they haven't been here for 3 or 4 years. It was one of those things where I realized how lacking our intelligence is in this part of the world. I realized, probably for the first time in my life, that we don't know what's going on, and that America doesn't know what's going on in these parts of the world, and that any intelligence we have on where the militants are or aren't isn't any good. And they told us we were the first Westerners in about a dozen years to be there. And we walked from village to village down that valley.
So I just knew America according to the map, the old map. And then the second time I knew America when America was bombing Afghanistan.
Yes.
And so the next year I decided to come back. I wanted to do a big mountaineering, maybe a ski mountaineering traverse, and do a magazine article about that. And I got the help of a mountain guide who's for the purposes of this story, we'll call him Kubad. And he and I went up there, and we began trekking, basically, to see if this pass would work out for a later ski expedition. And we stopped to visit, and we visited a farmer named Hayrat, who I'd met the summer before. And I'd known was a really good guy. And we're sitting around in his house one night. He's got this little whitewashed, tiny house. He himself is missing some fingers from a mine back in the Civil War, Tajikistan. And he's sitting around feeding us potato soup, because that's all there ever is in that valley. And he says, you know, there's a kid in the valley who's been to America. And I said, well, I don't think that's true. No one here has really been out too much out of Tajikistan. He said, no, seriously. He's been to America. He was in prison there. They made a big mistake. And I said, well, okay. And he said, yeah, he was in Cuba. And I said, Cuba? And he said, yeah, Cuba. I put it together. I knew that they'd been releasing the first prisoners from Guantanamo. And I was like, wow, this is one of them. And at the time, there really hadn't been any interviews with these people who had been released. There hadn't been any news from what's it like inside Guantanamo. It had all been sort of smoke and mirrors with the media trying to visit. So I was very excited to go track this guy down. So it took a couple days, but we got our jeep and went down the valley and met him.
So he went in October 2001, mm-hmm. Pakistan, and he was prisoned in May 2002.
Okay.
In 6 months, yeah.
So for those, what was he doing in those 6 months?
Chokhari badam, shashmo.
Shashmo is kashad, korka, mekhagashad khundo, mekhagashad gashad.
Partly walking, partly studying. Mm. Yeah, actually he didn't like Pakistan because of climate, everything. Actually, he says it's not as a good place, but he had to finish his school.
Yeah.
He had to have his diploma, and this is the most important thing, to have a diploma.
Was he a good student?
A good student. Student in Nazmi.
Hi.
A good one. In Tajikistan, there are boys that don't like to study.
Yeah.
No, they'd like to make a business.
Pagai saatoy pan shash KGB pokstonya oisi.
And one day, and 5-6 in the morning, the secret service of Pakistan came.
Asidroskan vada pirawodami omone.
So there was a library where they had a small office.
Office.
Small office, yeah.
So it was in a little room in a library, or?
Yeah. Amu kitobxona, dadunin kitobxona yak daftar bud, yak office bud ki, amu koroy yakum kim tojikish korxonay mayda bud.
Durus? Ina mo, ina misol nami khona, ya? Nami kitobxona. Umadan khob, dime khob ve dor mukan.
So they came, we were sleeping that time. They woke us up.
Garoftan murad chishmo bastan, stor bastan.
So they took the eyes, how to say?
They covered their eyes?
Yeah, they covered their eyes. And they
they
took this t-shirts and
his own t-shirt.
Yeah. Yes, the t-shirt.
And made the eye thing out of the t-shirt? And then the handcuff out of the t-shirt. And then what was he wearing on top?
But she pushed you.
I was just a girl who had told that.
Ah, so that they had something.
This happened to be about 10 days after the first suicide bombing that Pakistan had ever had. There was a bus that had been blown up by a car bomber outside the Sheraton in Karachi. So this was Pakistan's first suicide bombing, which, you know, now they've had so many. And it was after that happened that there were ads in the paper saying, report any suspicious foreigners. Well, here are these two Tajik guys staying in a library. And so the best guess is that someone reported them. And the agents came at night, and then they were taken to prison.
So then he brought him to one room. He said beton in Russian. Concrete.
Concrete.
And in a concrete room, which was 50 centimeters wide and 1 meter long. And then he stayed there for 10 days with the hands,
tied.
They put him in a tiny cell. This is one of a number of times he was put in a cell that seems to have been the size of a refrigerator. And he was there for quite some time. He got taken to some Americans who interrogated him at what sounded sort of like a luggage factory. At least there were a lot of suitcases and briefcases around. That's how he described it.
So, the two Americans, what did they look like?
Rambo.
I saw Rambo. And what is he was saying here? He had the cut off arms?
Yeah, yeah.
Please describe everything he just said. It seemed
It's the same as you've seen in the movie.
Yeah, so he had the cut off arms, but he did some things. And he had the headband.
In Jabanda goes? So he was not in uniform.
What questions did they ask?
Do saate ki venga mu prso purskara chi savlo mekara.
Avar shuna boray shakhsiyat khodam chi khel magish.
So first again about your personal information.
Pad da boray mi chi. Ami terrorist ra kusa mishnus ya kusa ti da.
And they said, do you know any terrorist?
Ti da shina mi da me do.
Have you seen them? Have you heard about them?
Khamna me pasdagi misol Al-Qaeda ra mishnusi.
He's been asked, do you know Al-Qaeda? Al-Qaeda.
Usama ra didai mishnusi.
Have you seen Osama bin Laden?
گفتم او شنیدم.
Yes, I've heard, but.
در تلویزیون در رادیو در
خواب. I've seen him in in TV.
Was he afraid?
Or were the other? ترسیدیم وق.
نیم وقت دخا چی میترم چکم
نه سر I didn't because I knew that I didn't do anything but
he told me I knew I was going to be freed because I'm not a thief. I didn't do anything. They'll realize it's a mistake. But pretty soon he was flown off to Bagram Air Base in Afghanistan. And if you think about it, it's the barriers to entry are pretty low in this kind of thing. There were stories of the CIA, in fact, paying Pakistanis to bring in militants at the time. And the barriers to exit are extremely high. I mean, we've got people just... He was sort of in limbo. Nobody knew why he was there, but nobody wanted to take the chance to release him.
One day, one woman, investigator, had talking with them. Mm-hmm.
ای پرسید اگه من گفت تو یکان گناه نداری نیکی نمی دونم چی فتر آوردن اینجا
So this woman also said according to you to the conversation we had you are not guilty yeah. You don't know why they brought you here.
What he told me was that interrogator after interrogator including this one at Bagram said I don't know why you're here. They said that to his face and yet he kept on getting moved in the system and eventually they were all rounded up one day and put in a plane and flown to Guantanamo.
Once having lunch, stand up, everybody stand up.
They were just one day just eating lunches?
Yeah, and they put their gloves and they put them gloves. In their hands, yeah, and then they fixed them with the scotch, the gloves.
Tip them.
Also, the special eyeglasses, which not allow you to see anything, and then
the face mask.
Those photos that we all saw from Guantanamo, with the men in orange prison suits, with the hoods and the chains, getting frog marched into camp. That's how they brought Umar out to Cuba.
They couldn't breathe well with them.
At Khaloskan, kuftan sawal dori, kuftan bali, kuftan ijak jay, kuftan khay Cuba jazira.
Ah, so good. Do you have any questions? To say yes. Where I am? I say, you are in Cuba.
They said you are in Cuba. Finally, you have an answer.
But ba kadam sabab man awardi.
And the second question would, why you brought me here? What was my crime?
What was the answer?
And I say, according to your speech, according to your information, you are not guilty.
They said, we don't know why you're here.
Yeah.
He was a very positive person going into this, obviously. He kept thinking, I'm going to be free. This is a mistake. He didn't seem to have any particular beef with America. He didn't know much about America until, as you said, the bombs began falling in Afghanistan. And so he kept thinking he was going to be freed, but after a time he thought, maybe this isn't about me.
My impression was that at the first 5 months I was thinking that they are really looking for terrorists who belong to terrorist groups. They want to fight against... against the terrorism,
yeah.
Against this Al-Qaeda and something like that. But after that, I had a new impression that they're not against terrorism, but they're against Islam.
The other people with him in the cell?
Yeah.
Did he think to himself, with me they made a mistake, but with these guys they did not make a mistake?
Miga, amu odamu ke bo tu dachi budan, demu khuna, demu jira. Those who I didn't know, I thought, oh, they are guilty. But later in Cuba, when he met some other people, then he understood there were many of them like him.
ده موها گلک قطی پدرش دم جای دختر گرتم بودنش مصفت یک ساعت پنسوره نمیشنم و نمیبینم نامدینه را گشتم بیتون.
That was interesting. Him and a man who was 100 years old.
What?
With the big beard. You couldn't even hear well.
100 years old? Where was he from?
Azgijobda Musafir. He was from Afghanistan. And another guy, he had a small child, a 10-month child.
In the prison?
کودکتی کودکی ده موها
خاطی پدرش دیگه جروز بود ده یک هفته یک بار پدرش میتونیست که بینم بلکش
در یک هفته؟
یک بار پدرش میتونیست که براو
So in one month this guy was allowed to visit his child only once
خیلی دمونی بینست
So his child was brought from Afghanistan or
یعنی او مرده که با انگولک شو ورنه افغانستان
ای نیک نه قسطان رو در پاکستان رو در مصد که ای دختر رو بردنش دختر رو
This guy took his baby and went to visit a doctor and then he was arrested
He was arrested at the doctor amazing
اکسانه چی بگنه
Even those people investigators say not only you are not guilty there are a lot of people who are not guilty
One thing we did get news about in the States was suicides. Mm-hmm. That there were many suicides in Guantanamo. Did he ever see them or experience this?
Yes, some people they hang themselves.
Hang themselves using their clothing. چه
می‌بختن چیست فردم که اگر چی نداشتن
همین چی داشتن پروسین پروسین می‌بختن نباستن خشون کشون
so they used this
used their sheets
yeah
how many times did he see this
چند بار دیدی این خیلی
توی می دیدیم 15 کس 20 کسی که خشون دور می کشید
so for instance 15-20 people suicided themselves once
did he ever think about suicide
میگه تو خود در فکر نبودی
دای فکر بدم نکه بخواه این نگاه اسلامی کار حرام بوده کنی
So yes I was also thinking about that but according to the Islam it's
اگرانی اول ادام من بدم که کار میکنم
It's not good
Did he lose all hope that he would ever be free?
Yeah, I'm Guantanamo چیزم امیدم نداشتی که خلاص میشه No
دیگه امیدی برمدن نیست
So in these 2 years I've been in Guantanamo no one was afraid so He didn't think about freedom.
We focus so much on, is torture okay? Did we torture these people? And was it worth it? And the reality is maybe there's this small class of hardened Al-Qaeda prisoners who are being tortured or were tortured, and who there is a legitimate debate there. But there's this other class of people like Umarov, who were swept up in the war on terror, put in this prison for years, and maybe we didn't waterboard them, but they did lock them up for 2 years. They did bind their hands and cover their eyes and put them in sensory deprivation, you know, goggles and fly them to Cuba and back. And that's the story that no one's really focused on, and I think that's maybe the more important story.
Was there a time that was worst of all?
Every day was the same. Each week... He's been called to have this
interrogation. Yeah.
So the questions were the same. The only investigators were different.
So the different investigator comes in and asks always, who are you? How are you here? Do you know Al-Qaeda? Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Do you know where Bin Laden is?
Yeah.
I had the understanding maybe an hour or two into our 8-hour conversation that I'm asking him exactly what interrogator after interrogator after interrogator has asked him. How did you get here? What are all the steps? He seemed to tire of them, and he became more agitated at the end. And I was very aware that I had just this one moment with him. I had to get back to the States. I was... certain that the Defense Department would not want to do any fact-checking with me. So this was it. This is one of those stories that you can't fact-check too well, and you can only know if it's real or not by, one, your gut, and then whatever else you can pick up along the way. So I just wanted to make sure the story was airtight. When he had his final conversation with one of the interrogators at Guantanamo, they took him to this room, the same interrogation rooms they always took him to, but this time they took him without shackles. And then they sat him down in front of this middle-aged American man, maybe 50-year-old white man.
He said, whenever the war happened, a lot of people involved in wars, and sometimes people who are not guilty, they're also involved in this process.
This is what the man said?
Yeah.
He
did apologize and say, you know, we are not against Islam, we are against these people who are thinking bad things, terrorists, and that, and say, it's a sorry, we burned two years of your life, and we want very much you to not contact with bad people. Uh-huh. And if someone would say that, let's fight against America, then contact them, then be with them, just set up your life. Yeah. They took him like this.
They hugged him.
Yeah.
I asked him, of course, how did you feel? Did you come out mad? Did you come out a terrorist, even if you didn't start out as one? And no. His answer over and over again was no. Mm-hmm. And he said, you know, there are many stories within Islam of people being imprisoned unfairly.
So if you knew the history of Islam, then you get more quiet.
Yeah.
He looked to religion for some sort of solace.
Religion teaches us to be a quiet, patient.
The first thing I did when I got back was I emailed Harper's Magazine and I emailed the New York Times Magazine and I said, I just found one of the first Guantanamo detainees to be released. He has an incredible story. Are you interested? And both of them, for their own reasons, said, sorry. And so I made myself a list, a Word document that I still have here. And have on the list the NY Times Magazine, The Atlantic, Vanity Fair, Esquire, Harper's, New Yorker, GQ, Rolling Stone, Washington Post Magazine, LA Times Magazine, Boston Globe Magazine. Those were all ones that I pitched, and I would put a little, I'd cross them out after they weren't interested. One of the reasons I think it was so hard for me to get this published was that it was an impossible story to confirm. Like, how can we confirm any of this? Why should we believe his word against that of, you know, everyone in the military and everyone in the political establishment? Like, why would we believe some guy who'd been in Guantanamo when he says, I wasn't a terrorist? It's like, every guy in prison is innocent, right? Finally, after crossing a half dozen other magazines off my list, I went to Mother Jones. It wasn't a story that a lot of people saw. Five years later, in 2011, when WikiLeaks released the Guantanamo files, I typed in Umarov's name. Also, Homaro, because they had his name wrong in the official files. It doesn't say much, and yet here in their documents is exactly what he told me. That he was arrested by Pakistani police and held in a Karachi jail for a month, then sent to Afghanistan. That he'd been arrested in a library, even that little detail. The date matched up, the fact that no one knows why he was there, as an EC, they call it in this document, enemy combatant. No one knows why he was determined to be one, even though it says that he was determined to be an enemy combatant before he was sent to Guantanamo, whatever that means. One detail I didn't find in the WikiLeaks documents, and this is shocking in and of itself, is that Umarov wasn't compensated in any way for his experience. He was just dumped back in Tajikistan with nothing. And he does now suffer from a host of physical problems. He said that his eyesight was damaged from looking through so many chain-link fences. And he wasn't the only one who said that. Other prisoners have reported the same. He says he has breathing problems now. He says he has back problems. When we started doing the interview, he just returned from getting injections from a local doctor for the lungs, I think. But the United States didn't offer him anything. And this is something that really bothers me a lot. I think about it all the time. And I asked him about it. And he didn't seem angry about it. He just seemed more amazed. For him, it was almost like a sign that they thought he was still guilty, because otherwise they would offer him something. The one thing that seemed to make him angry, as far as I could tell, was his nickname.
Osama.
The villagers call him Osama.
They're joking, but when you are not guilty and you hear this, of course, it's not pleasant.
I decided it was a good time to do a post on how to identify and avoid spreading misinformation on the internet.
Adam Pasch is the editor of Life Hacker, one of those websites that supposedly helps us streamline and organize our digital lives. When Osama bin Laden was killed, the internet's exploded. Rumors, fake photos, conspiracy theories, hoaxes. Overnight, there was just too much disinformation. One particular story caught his attention.
There was this quote that started getting passed around by Martin Luther King Jr. The quote went something like, "I mourn the loss of thousands of precious lives, but I will not rejoice in the death of one, not even an enemy." And it's a really nice sentiment, but Martin Luther King Jr. never actually said it. There was a woman on Facebook who quoted something from Martin Luther King Jr. that was actually from him and had a small statement of her own at the beginning of it, not inside of the quotes, but eventually when people were passing it around, the quotes got removed, and it was just her sentiment attributed to Martin Luther King Jr. And that got passed around on Twitter, and Gillette retweeted it to millions of followers.
So it was a game of internet telephone.
Yeah, it's exactly like internet telephone. Things get lost in translation, and what you were left with was a bit of internet misinformation.
Adam Pasch decided to publish a friendly how-to guide, a four-step program, disinformation for dummies, so to speak. Step one, if it quacks like a duck, it probably is a duck.
And of course, the too good to be trueness of, say, like, you've been selected for a free iPad, most people don't have any confusion about those. Most people can get those right away. This seems like a real thing, and there's nothing, no one's going to gain anything taking advantage of me if I'm just accepting this information. It's not trying to trick anyone, really. It just sort of happened. But at the same time, there is sort of, you know, it seems a little too on the nose, and that is the case with a lot of these sorts of things.
Step two, before you retweet, resend, or reblog, find a source, a trusted source, and verify.
Yeah, it's all about sort of finding sources that you trust and using them in the right way. One website that is really popular and generally a good source of debunking myths, urban legends, folklore, and whatnot is Snopes.com. It's been around since 1995, and it's basically to debunk urban legends.
Yeah, but Adam, most people go to sources that already confirm what they believe in. You know, I can go to Snopes.com and type in Obama Kenya birth certificate, and yes, it does say that it is indeed a forgery. But if I'm a birther, I'm just never going to go there. I'm going to go to a site that confirms my own beliefs. I mean, we've reached a point now where we can pick and choose our own facts. So I guess what you call step three is the most important step of all. Just don't hit send.
Yeah, we're still talking about, you know, just like sharing links. This isn't dissertation type vetting. You don't have to, you know, it's not the end of the world if one time you get duped. And it happens to most of us at some point in time. Like this Martin Luther King Jr. quote, if you've gone through the steps, you know, if you've employed your skepticism and you're still feeling good about it, of course go ahead and send something. But be a little wary before you do, you know, employ that skepticism, be smart about it, and you know, hopefully you can employ a little bit of extra intelligence and won't get spread on the internet instead of maybe contributing to the sort of misinformation that's really easy to pass along.
You know, it really does come down to us though, doesn't it? When it comes to figuring out what's real and what's not, it's up to us. Terrifying.
Yeah, it's a big responsibility, actually. You know, it's the kind of thing that previously was sort of limited to the people who made the news, who wrote the news, you know, the people who have whole industries built on ideally spreading true information that people can just sort of trust. But we're all publishing things now, all the time. And there's a weird level of responsibility that's placed on all of us when that happens that has never really been an issue. You know, people go to school and learn to do research and write papers and sort of construct arguments and do some sort of critical thinking on sort of ideas and what's real and what's not. But at the same time, you know, you were going from books and these big things that had already gone through all of this vetting and all this research and they sort of had gone through the process as well. Now I can write something and publish it in a couple minutes, and it's to anyone to decide whether or not it's real and pass it along. And that sort of thing can snowball really quickly, especially if the content has sort of that, you know, tempting scratch and itch, this would be really fun to share thing.
And it would be really great if it was true.
Exactly.
What we know for sure is that Osama bin Laden's body was dumped over the side of a Navy ship for burial at sea. But what most people don't know is that the body was not in the water for very long.
What do you mean?
There was a submarine waiting beneath the surface for the body to be dumped in the water, and an elite team swam out from the submarine, caught the body as it was sinking, and the body was taken to our base in Diego Garcia.
I don't understand. Why would they take him there?
Well, it turns out that the best Army taxidermists are on Diego Garcia.
Taxidermy? You're really confusing me.
Let me explain how hunting works. Big game hunting takes a lot of time and a lot of effort. And sometimes most of the time, in fact, you come up with nothing. So when you do get that prize and you do bag that lion, you don't just throw it away. That's your trophy, and you want to put it up on your wall.
So you're telling me they're going to stuff bin Laden's head and just put it on someone's wall?
Absolutely. I mean, this is how we do it. This is the way it's been from the beginning. Like, you've heard about Geronimo's skull, haven't you?
No, I don't know that story.
Well, during World War I, it was 1918, six members of the Yale secret society called Skull and Bones were Army volunteers at Fort Sill, Oklahoma. And at the time, Geronimo was buried there. One of those guys was actually Prescott Bush, the first George Bush's father, George W.'s grandfather. He was actually the ringleader.
Okay.
Anyway, these guys exhumed Geronimo's tomb, and they stole his skull and some bones. And to this day, that skull resides in a secret tomb at the headquarters of Skull and Bones.
So something similar is going to happen then to OBL?
Well, according to my guy...
Who is your guy, by the way?
You've seen those pictures of the guys in the Situation Room while this was going down, right?
Oh, yeah.
Well, he's the one guy that didn't make it into frame.
But he's there.
He was there.
Why isn't he in the picture then?
Well, you know the hot chick in the back that everybody's been talking about?
Uh-huh, yeah. The one with the dark hair?
Yeah. Well, he used to date her. And I guess things are still like a little touchy between them. And it's already a super tense situation, so he just didn't want to deal with that. So he was just kind of standing away from her, right next to the photographer. So that's why he wasn't in the picture.
And so did he tell you what they're looking at?
Yes. It's the dog cam. One of the members of that SEAL team was a dog, highly trained dog. In fact, he may have been the bravest member of the team because he went in first. So this dog didn't go in naked, of course. I mean, these dogs, there's a lot of info online, actually, about some of the equipment they have. But, you know, they got armor. They have, of course, the camera, the dog cam is mounted. There's earbuds so that they can get commands remotely. And they also have special weaponry. Now, that dog was basically the strike team leader. His mission was to go get Bin Laden. So here's what my friend saw. The dog goes through the compound, beeline up the stairs, goes to a doorway, okay? Apparently knocks the door down. And apparently across the room, the back of the room, you could make out that it was Bin Laden, okay? So... the dog heads right at Bin Laden, and then there's some commotion, and kind of from the side, this woman comes out of nowhere. I don't know, maybe she was in a bathroom or something, and comes out from the side and starts kicking at the dog. So the dog has to turn its attention to the woman. It clamps down on the woman's leg, and this is one of the things the media got wrong, actually, is that they, you know, you heard the woman with a gunshot wound to the leg. Uh-huh. Well, it was actually a dog bite. So now apparently this is pretty wild because my friend is describing the dog is, you know, bitten down on this woman's leg and is, you know, shaking it back and forth. And while this shaking is going on, you hear a pop. A second or two later, the dog lets go of the woman and turns his attention back to Bin Laden, who you see from the video feed is now just kind of laying on the floor. And so the dog does what it's trained to do. It goes over, it sniffs the body, and it goes up to the face, locates the wound. There's blood pouring out of the Bin Laden's head. And the dog does what it's trained to do. It takes the picture. And that's the picture that was used for the facial recognition. And then once that information was relayed to the SEAL team, they saw that it was verified. That he was, in fact, EKIA, enemy killed in action. He calls up to the dog, Geronimo Ikea. So that was the dog's cue. The dog then grabbed Bin Laden, dragged him out, dragged him down the stairs and out to the SEAL team, where they got everybody on the helicopters and got the hell out of there.
So the dog shot Bin Laden.
As they say, buddy, fog of combat. Fog of combat.
So, what then is going to happen to Osama bin Laden's body?
Well, that remains to be seen. There are a lot of interested parties, and it's probably going to be a battle. But I know of one person who was very interested who is not getting him, and that's George W. Bush. In fact, he was so mad about it, he completely threw a tantrum. And that's why he refused President Obama's invitation to go to Ground Zero.
This episode of Too Much Information is called Geronimo IKEA. It was produced by myself, Benjamin Walker, with Bill Bowen and Laura Mayer. It featured Dustin Craig, Mackenzie Funk, Umarov Mohibolo, Adam Pash, and our TMI Washington, D.C. correspondent, Chris. There's even more information, including links and photos, on the TMI show page. And that's where you can subscribe to the TMI podcast as well. All that at WFMU.org.
Good evening. We're a few minutes into another edition of Mud Up here on WFMU. I'm DJ Rupture, your host for the next hour, taking you through. And I started off with a Drudy column. So it looks like a brand new 2-CD album by Vinnie Riley, a.k.a. Drudy column. You know, an old guy from Manchester factory back in the day, in the early 80s. And it finds him in good form doing that thing. It's really, I really enjoy what he does. It's kind of unattached to any beat, these floating, lovely, kind of spiky guitar work, guitar melodies. And that is, it's the CD, it's Drudy Column / Vinnie Riley. So that's sort of the name of the artist, that's the name of the title, out on Kookie Disc. And then now we are listening to Downliner's Sect, Hockey Nights in Canada.